The Spectator magazine combines incisive political analysis with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online, plus a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to the Spectator's Books Podcast. I'm Sam Leith, the literary editor of the Spectator. This week, my guest is Dr. Kat Jarman. And Kat's new book is called River Kings, A New History of Vikings from Scandinavia to the Silk Roads, which is wider than we thought Vikings may have gone. But Kat, it begins with something very small indeed, doesn't it? It's a single carnelian bead sets you off on this substantial work of scholarship. Tell me about that.
Yes, that's right. It's probably a bit surprising how that very small object can try and tell that very big story. But that was part of what I wanted to do. I wanted to get that contrast between how we are learning so much from very, very small objects. You don't necessarily need a huge, big and important source, but actually something quite unexpected can take you in a different direction. And actually, this bead in itself, as I start the book with, did start me on that new way of thinking as well very much, because it kind of represented something that I hadn't really thought about, and that was exactly the sort of direct contact between the Vikings that we're familiar with here in Britain and those who came and raid and attacked monasteries in that very traditional story, and those who went all the way to the east and all the very, very large trading networks that extended all the way to the Silk Road. So that bead really very much started the story for me, which is why I wanted to start the book with it as well.
Well, tell us about this bead. It was found in the UK in Repton, is that right?
That's right, yes. So Repton is probably one of the better known Viking Age sites in England. It was the winter camp of the Viking Great Army that sort of marauded around the country from the 860s onwards. And the site it's very much a kind of traditional Viking picture. You have an attack on a monastery, you have a desecration of old royal burials, and also excavations in the 80s found a huge number of bodies, so Viking graves, definite sort of warrior graves with Thor's hammer and sword and all the what you would expect essentially from a Viking burial, as well as a very large mass burial of nearly 300 people found underneath a mound. And we sort of known that story for quite some time, but this bead was also discovered in the 80s, this carnelian bead, but it was kind of forgotten about. And I came across it in 2017 and started learning a bit more and realising that actually that bead had travelled all the way, most likely from Gujarat in India, to Repton in the 9th century. And that really was the starting point to try to move away from that traditional story and see what other connections we might have.
I mean, as you say, there is a traditional story of Vikings, and we think of them as these sort of very sort of smelly, violent, hairy-arsed articles coming over from Scandinavia and sort of basically arriving in Northumbria, smashing up the monasteries, setting fire to the sheep, hauling away the women folk. And is that what they were actually like? I mean, is there truth in that image, or, you know, were they sensitive souls?
I think there's a bit of both there. So that is definitely a side to the Vikings that we can't ignore. There was a lot of violence. There was a lot of that. I think the reason why we focus so much on that side is because the written sources, the contemporary written sources, especially from England, focus on that. So the attack on Lindisfarne, for example, which sort of kicks off the whole Viking Age, is very graphic in detail of exactly what sort of atrocities were carried out. But the Vikings weren't the only people being violent in the 8th, 9th century. And in fact, I would think that they sort of gave as good as they got in a way that actually they're locals too, perhaps not the monks in the monasteries. But certainly warfare was a very important part of early medieval life. But there is a big other side to the Vikings too, which is the sort of peaceful side. And the peaceful settlement of England is perhaps not quite as well known, and other parts of the world as well. And especially after the Second World War, when the Vikings were very much used as propaganda for Nazi Germany, after that, there was a bit of an increase in the sort of softer side of the Vikings. The researchers were quite kind of tired of just focusing on the violence and wanted to explore this sort of trading side especially. And that's really developed. But I think we've now reached a side where we know that they're both a part of the picture. But I'm interested in also telling that other side, that the extensive global networks that they were part of.
Yeah, and this, I mean, one of the extraordinary things about the Vikings that goes through your story is that they had a sort of set of technologies that allowed them not only to raid and conquer and set fire to stuff, but to trade and establish bases and areas of operation all through the world. Can you tell me a bit about these technologies? They were a great seafaring people, you know, that was obviously what we know about them.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the Viking ship certainly was a massive part of the Viking success. And it's not a coincidence that in the late 8th century, when we see the start of the Viking era, that's also when these ships start to really develop. I don't think the ship itself was a cause for the Viking Age, but it facilitated the wide-ranging movement. So that what was new about the Viking ship really was it was the use of sails and it was use of a keel, which made these ships very stable, able to cross the North Sea, the North Atlantic, far and wide. But they were also very shallow and very suitable to landing on beaches, going down shallow rivers, even being dragged over land if needed. And that meant that through using these ships, the Vikings could actually take advantage of so many different circumstances. So you can kind of go in the same ship across the North Sea or across to Iceland. You can bring cattle with you, and you can also quite quickly and silently launch attacks on suspecting monks in monasteries. So this kind of really, really helped it. But as well as that, I think in a lot of parts of the world, the people that sort of we think of as the Vikings would be very good at taking advantage of whatever they needed to take advantage of at times. So in some places, that would mean using different types of vessels, different types of boats. In the rivers in the east, for example, which I talk quite a lot about in the book, we see them using smaller vessels and then actually building and adapting from other parts types of technology. So it's really a big key is knowing how to take advantage of technology for whatever circumstance is needed.
Yeah, and you have these moments, sort of eureka moments, when you find a tiny little bit of iron. Right, that's a ship's nail. We know that they were repairing ships here. And that tells you something about what they were doing, doesn't it? I mean, for instance, it begins with you trying to figure out, you know, at Repton and a little upriver from there, you're trying to figure out, you know, what the Great Army was actually doing. You know, what was the pattern? Because we know that they went on to sort of settle substantial parts of what's now the UK. But at that point, what were they up to? And why were they in Repton over winter, as it were?
Yeah, so this Great Army appears to have had a very seasonal pattern of raiding, which meant that they would launch most of their attacks and move around the country in the spring. And then in the autumn, they would set up camps, or these winter camps, which are recorded quite well in the Anglo-Saxon Chronicles. So we have this contemporary record that tells us in the year 873, for example, they go to Repton. So some of that is to be able to facilitate this movement. And what's clear when we hear about the Great Army from these records is that it's a bit of a step up. So there's a difference from what we see right at the beginning of the Viking Age. We're not talking about just quick sort of hit and run raids anymore, like we saw at the beginning, not just looking for loot and then heading back home. But we're actually looking at quite a targeted political conquest. So we are talking about a group that's moving around the country, aiming to take over the Anglo-Saxon kingdoms. So Repton is a part of Mercia at the time, and this was sort of one of the key aims at the time. They'd already conquered various other kingdoms, and now they wanted Mercia. And Repton was sort of the jewel in the crown, if you like, of that. It was the very much the kind of religious capital. It was where all the Mercian royals were being buried in what's now St. Wiston's Church. And so by taking Repton, they could essentially take control. And in fact, they sort of scare off the Mercian king, who goes into exile and never comes back. And then they install a puppet king in his place that they can have a sort of have control over. So we're talking about people who are actually now, they're doing something much bigger. They are looking at a much grander scale. But on a practical level, you have what's probably a force of many thousand. We now think maybe about 5,000-6,000 or so people who are moving around and having to do certain things over winter. So you have to work out how to feed them, you have to work out how to repair those ships because they're quite fragile, you have to have the weapons, you have to have all the resources. So these camps and these objects, you know, the bit of iron that you mentioned turns out to be a ship nail that tells us that they're fixing, they're repairing boats. You know, you can get spindle whorls that show us that they're making fabrics, maybe repairing sails. And so you sort of, you
there's
get the
sails,
two scales.
Incidentally, there's an absolutely staggering statistic in the book about these woolen sails that they used. How much wool you'd have needed. Could you?
Yes, I would have to look up. I can't actually remember.
Well, it's something like, I mean, is it like thousands or many, many hundreds of uninterrupted days of labour to make a single sail? They need, what, 1,000 metres squared or something?
Yes, absolutely. So there's some calculations have been made looking at exactly that. And I think it's over a year's worth of labour just to produce a single sail. And it's really quite staggering because you don't really think of that. You don't think of those resources that are needed just for one single boat, one single sail. And so obviously when that tears and rips along the way, then you're in trouble. So there's a lot of logistics behind every raid and every attack.
You've got a Viking somewhere, haven't you, who's, you know, again, this big butch Viking who's reduced to tears when the king confiscates his sail.
Absolutely, because that is, you know, that's his future. That's his dreams and his ambitions are all tied up in this sail. And so we tend to not really think about that because the written sources would never, you know, they didn't really talk about the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle. It doesn't tell you about the sails. It tells you about the kings and the rulers and the battles.
In terms of sort of figuring out, you know, what they're up to, there's some extraordinary modern technology that comes into the book that I'm gripped by. For instance, I mean, you talk about this sort of aerial laser photography where you could suddenly sort of take an X-ray of the land and strontium analysis for, obviously, presumably the last 10 or 15 years has produced a whole bunch of knowledge in your field that, you know, wouldn't have been available before. Can you tell me how all that
Absolutely.
Works?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think this is really the exciting thing. And for me, being in this field is why I feel like it's such an exciting time to be part of it, because we are developing so many methods now that tell us things that we could only dream of 20 years ago, or even 10 years ago. So one of those that you mentioned is LiDAR, which is sort of laser photography. And what that allows us to do is get a really detailed view of the landscape, so or the topography. And we can use it for things like tracing old rivers. But quite excitingly, in terms of the Vikings, is it allows us to search for things like burial mounds. The reason it can do that is that the images essentially can go through foliage and trees. So you're not dependent on being actually to able to walk across an area and look at the lumps and bumps. You can get this aerial view. And it's actually quite fun. And if you've got some spare time, you can go online. In England, the Environment Agency have made these maps and this sort of data sets available freely. So you can sort of, from home, you can go to sites like lidarfinder.com and you can literally just search like you would on Google and you can look for lumps and bumps in the landscape. And it's really quite extraordinary and very exciting. So that gives an idea of finding sites. And then a lot of what I do is in the field of bioarchaeology. So that's looking at human remains and looking at the chemical signatures that we have in our bodies, because we are basically walking diaries of our lives, and everything that we eat and drink leaves a trace in our hair, in our skin. And what's good for us as archaeologists is that the same thing is the case for our bones and our teeth. And they're, of course, preserved for, you know, thousands of years in the ground. So you can take samples of the body of somebody you think might have been a Viking, and you can find out things about where they grew up, what sort of food they ate, and that sort of unlocks just a whole new world.
It's extraordinary. It's an extraordinary little bit where this, I think it's strontium dating that does the teeth, where you say, we had this puzzle, we thought that these bodies must all be 9th century, they fit perfectly with this, but then 5 or 6 of them seem to be like decades wrong. And you,
yes.
How did you sort of square that circle?
Yeah, so that's one of the sort of earliest parts of the research that I got involved with, actually. That particular one, what to do with fish consumption and correcting radiocarbon dates. Because when this mass grave that I mentioned briefly earlier in Repton was first discovered, it was thought that this was the Great Army, that it should date to the 9th century. But some of the bodies, when they were radiocarbon dated, turned out to be several hundred years too early. So they couldn't possibly be Vikings. And then what we now know is that if you eat a lot of fish or any other seafood, that actually affects the carbon in your body, because carbon in oceans, in fish, circulates around for a really long time, and that's something we have to take into account. So if basically if a fish and a sheep were killed by a Viking on the same day 1,000 years ago, if I came to dig them up 1,000 years later and radiocarbon date them, it would look like actually they lived 400 years apart. And that difference also is passed on to anybody who eats that fish or eats that sheep. So if you, for example, tend to just, you know, every day just eat fish in your food, then it wouldn't look like you were alive in the 2020. It would look like you had lived, you know, in a completely different time. So knowing that, I was able to look at the diets, so analyze the diets of these people, which is another thing we can do with isotope analysis, and then take into account the difference. And it was...
Was there a sort of eureka moment when someone figured that out?
Yeah, absolutely. So you get these little steps and people work it out in different fields, and then suddenly you go, okay, well, we have to apply this to this mystery that is Repton and these possible Viking burials. And it was probably one of the nicest moments of my career so far, actually. Just you plot all the values into a computer and you sort of press the button and you wait for a graph to come up and it sort of aligns beautifully, and there's your answer, which is fantastic.
Now, this Repton grave, it's one of the other sort of questions about it, or mysteries about it, is that you started to...
Yes.
You know, you said there were women in there, and more than you had expected. And again, we think of the Vikings as very sort of, you know, male. And as I think in some earlier theories, you know, they came over here because they had a shortage of women folk on the mainland. And how did the discovery of Repton and your investigations into that change or bear on your understanding of Viking women and what they did? Why were they here?
Yes, that was a really interesting one. So when the site was first excavated and analysed in the 80s and 90s, they did realise that quite early on that the mass grave, which had nearly 300 people in it, had about 20% women. But at the time, it was assumed that those would have been local women, so Anglo-Saxon women that were then married to or taken slaves by, you know, whatever the relationship to these Viking or Scandinavian men. And that was in part because at the time, it was very much assumed that those who came over from Scandinavia were almost exclusively men, and women would be sitting at home on the farm making those sails and just essentially waiting for their husbands and brothers and sons to come back home again. I think for a lot of women, that was the case. But what we know now from elsewhere is that actually women were very much a part of the movement outside of Scandinavia as well. So it's really not a case that all Scandinavian women stayed at home. We know that from things like the isotope analysis, so the chemical analysis of teeth, which can also tell you about where people came from. So we've found graves of and burials of women all over the place, and including in England, of women who clearly have migrated from Scandinavia. So that knowledge started to sort of reframe on who these women in Repton were. And when I carried out some of the analysis on their teeth as well, it showed that they definitely were not local women. And some of them could only, in fact, have come from places with old geology or colder climate, so places like Scandinavia. So it seems very likely that they came across with that great army. So then you can, of course, start to ask the questions, what were they doing? Were they just sitting back and sewing, or were they actually taking part in the sort of raiding force and in the battles?
And the question of whether they took part, you know, as you point out, obviously Viking mythology, as appropriated by Wagner, has warrior women in it. But there are a couple of graves, there's one in particular you talk about, that suggests that actually there may have been, you know, female fighting Vikings.
Yeah, so this has been a really big question, especially in the last few years, because a lot of the mythology does have these fighting women, things like the Valkyries, for example, and goddesses like Freya, who are all known for their sort of prowess in the battlefield. But knowing whether that is just mythology and a sort of fantasy, really, or something real is quite hard. But then a few years ago, one particular grave from Birka in Sweden, which is a very large trading settlement, trading town, which also had this very strong warrior culture, essentially lots of graves with a lot of weapons and so on. One of those graves, which has been really seen as a sort of archetypal warrior grave, containing a whole huge range of equipment, a weapon, two horses and so on, was always thought to be a man. But then a DNA analysis discovered something quite different, that in fact, this was the body of a biological female. And that, of course, took the internet and the whole world by storm, because it seemed to be evidence that this was a female warrior. Of course, not everyone accepted that interpretation, because there's all sorts of things saying, well, you know, we don't know if she really used the weapons, and we don't know if just because she was buried in this way that she was actually actively a warrior. But I think, you know, we need to think, if somebody is presented like that in death, then chances are they had that sort of role in life as well. So if we get someone like that in a place like Birka in Sweden, we have to say or ask the question about the women in a place like Repton as well. Would it not be possible that they also actively took part? And I think it's unlikely that you would be part of a group like that and not be able to, at the very least, defend yourself and take part if you needed to.
Now, it wasn't, as you say, just a matter of raiding. They were interested in political control to some extent. And this went east as well. And this is where, you know, we're tracing your carnelian bead now. And it's certainly, the Anglo-Saxon view of it isn't really conscious of how far east the Vikings went. About where did the evidence for that start to build up? And because you have them, essentially, you know, the Rus, you know, who are in what's now Ukraine and are, the sort of founding myth of Russia. You say these people were Vikings.
Yeah, so this is the big question. It's one that's been controversial for a very long time and still is very controversial. So these people that we call the Rus, are they Vikings or not? Are they Scandinavian or are they something else? There isn't really an easy answer to it. But if we look at the earliest sources, the first time we hear about them in a written record is in 839, so a few decades before Repton. And it's actually in Ingelheim, so it's in sort of Francia, and it's at the court of Louis the Pious, who is he has a visit from this delegation that's come from Byzantium. And they have with them a group that call themselves the Rus. And he hasn't heard of them before, he has no idea who they are, but they're coming to him to ask for help. And he's very suspicious and he interrogates them for quite some time, asks them about, you know, their origins. And they tell him that they are Swedes, basically, or from the people of the Swedes. And then later on, we have all these other records, especially from the Russian Primary Chronicle, that talk about the Rus and give this kind of origin story for essentially what's become the Rusians or Russians or Russia. And this also talks about the Rus as these people coming from the north, from places like Sweden, coming in to take over and establish the entire Rusian state. So that, again, links that to Scandinavia. And then we have all the archaeological evidence. We have lots of artifacts, lots of objects of definite clear Scandinavian origins. We know we have Scandinavian settlements. We know we have people going through. But the question is just, are these Rus people definitely the same as the Vikings? And that is still something that is quite contentious.
And how, if they are the same as the Vikings, if they're Scandinavian origin, how did they get there and when?
So we know that most of the travel is down through the river system. So it's down the Volga and the Dnieper. And we know that both from the archaeological material that's spread along the rivers. So you can see, if you look at any maps or plots of that, it's just all the little dots just appear along these river routes. And the rivers really, this is what led to the title of my book, really, was this focus on the rivers, is because they are really being taken advantage of. They are extremely efficient ways of travel, and in some places almost the only way of traveling. So we know that that's how they are able to spread. We also know that this starts really right at the beginning of the Viking Age. In fact, even before we start seeing the attacks in the West. So we start seeing the settlements, but we also start having objects and things coming from the East and into Scandinavia. So we have the kind of, not just things going out, but also stuff going back in. And that's especially things like silver. So dirham coins, Islamic coins, start to appear in vast quantities all over Scandinavia. And even, as we now know, more and more of them turning up in England as well.
Yeah, and you've got details of sort of like Viking graffiti, you know, people carving Viking, obviously Viking ships, into the stonework of Constantinople and Baghdad.
Absolutely. So I mean, that's what's so remarkable. You have real evidence of people going that far. So Constantinople or Istanbul was one of the major destinations. We know that from later written sources as well. But you can go into the Hagia Sophia Mosque, as it is now, and you can actually find graffiti with names. There's several names in runic characters, essentially a sort of Halfdan was here, just like you would do. We did that sort of thing as children, you know, you would sort of put your name places. And here you've got people doing it in the 9th and 10th centuries. And I think what I really love is that that just brings that human element to it. These are individual people who go on these great big journeys, just like we might do.
Now, is there a sense of when Vikings went somewhere? Obviously, they traded, and, you know, furs and silver and all the things that we know that went back and forth, and carnelian beads that went back and forth. But were they interested in taking and holding territory in a formal way, or did they like to squat by a river in a big military camp and simply take tithes and taxes from anyone who came past? I mean, what was their modus operandi?
So I think it's a combination of both. So some would have just been there for short-term gain. They would be there to get wealth and come back again. But others definitely were, in the same way as they were in England with the Great Army, looking for land. We don't know quite as much about that in the East as we do in the West. In the West, especially in places like England, we have a lot of records. And as we get towards the Norman Conquest, we get more and more documentary evidence of land ownership. And so we can sort of track that. In the East, we don't really have that. So I think for a long time, we've thought that it was very much more just a sort of passing through, setting up camps, taking advantage of whoever, you know, people or objects. But we are now wondering, perhaps there's more of a settlement pattern there in the East as well, that people are looking for land, looking for long-term land. And maybe that's where they sort of merge into this new Rus identity, because quite quickly you start to sort of combine with other cultures and assimilate, just like the Vikings did in England, but also there, sort of essentially merging into this new identity and losing some of the Scandinavian-ness and get these sort of melting pots, as it were.
Now, this identity is, obviously you're an archaeologist, you're interested in the past, but it's inescapably a huge political hot potato, isn't it?
Yeah, no, absolutely. This has been contentious for, you know, hundreds of years, really. And even today, that is quite contentious. And these terms, Vikings and Anglo-Saxon as well, are being, is what that means to a lot of people in the world today, is the way it is being used in some quite difficult and quite challenging ways. And a lot of that is tied up to our sort of quite modern beliefs of those identities, not necessarily what really happened 1,000 years ago.
In terms of, obviously, the Nazis appropriated the idea of Viking origins, which makes it tricky. But there's also this question that, you know, for a lot of Russian nationalists, what's now inconveniently Ukraine is the heartland, isn't it?
Absolutely. So that is really the key territory. And it's been difficult to study as well for a long time. So under the Soviet Union, looking at these Scandinavian and Vikings links was really not supported. And in fact, one of the sites that I work at in Ukraine, there was an archaeologist was sent from Moscow to prove that the Vikings were never there, that there was no Scandinavian input. So this female archaeologist was sent to excavate some burial mounds to show that they were definitely of a Slavic character and culture. Of course, that's not what she found at all. She found an awful lot of very definite Scandinavian evidence there, so that didn't really go as planned. But part of this goes back to those early records and this early idea that the Scandinavians or the Rus were called in to take control over these poor people who couldn't rule themselves. And you can see why that doesn't fit very well with anybody's origin story, really, the idea that the indigenous population were incapable of ruling themselves. So
also, you said the word Slav comes from slave, or slave comes from Slav.
Yeah, absolutely. So that is the name of the entire group relates to that slave trading. So that, again, gives us some indications to why it is so contentious today.
Do you have a sense, speaking of slave trading, of, again, mythology around the extent to which the Vikings were slavers and, indeed, you know, human sacrifice and so forth? What's the actual evidence? Is it possible to see how extensive Viking slave networks were, or is that something that gets lost in the archaeological record?
Yeah, that is a really, really difficult one, because it's very difficult to prove the evidence, you know, what how would you prove slavery? Because these slaves or these enslaved people become essentially invisible in the archaeological record. It's very difficult to prove that somebody was taken and forcibly migrated or moved around, taken advantage of. Usually we won't have the graves. They won't be given a burial in the same way that perhaps free people would have been given burials. And even if they are, how do you prove that sort of life history? So it is extremely difficult. The only real ways tend to be from the written records. But other than that, it's seeing the sort of goods that come back and the sort of wealth, knowing from other written sources. We've got some really fantastic contemporary Arabic sources as well that give us some idea of the slave trade. So if you take that into account and you look at all the wealth that's coming into Scandinavia, and some of that wealth in silver especially is really quite extraordinary. And you almost have to deduce what they could possibly be trading in returns. This trade in human lives is certainly a very big part of it. But to quantify it in any way is probably always going to be impossible.
You mentioned these Arabic sources. I mean, I think I'm right in saying the only contemporary description of a Viking burial is an Arabic one. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. So that's one of these descriptions of a Rus burial. So there's Ibn Fadlan, an Arabic traveller, essentially describes what we can now really recognise as a Viking burial. So even though he calls them the Rus, it's exactly the same as a burial that we find in the archaeological record in places like Scandinavia. And it's very graphic. It involves a lot of violence. It involves human sacrifice. But it is really quite extraordinary to see that as a big performance. It wasn't just a practical matter of putting a dead person in the ground. It's a performance that goes over a period of about 10 days or so. And it's really quite interesting reading.
And is it plausible to you? Do you think it's... Because a lot of the time, you're sifting out, this is propaganda, these are people who are scared of being attacked from the sea and they think these people are monsters. Does it read to you like something we can trust as a source?
I actually think it does, yeah. I think that some of the detail may be embellished or some of it might be misunderstood. We don't know how much of it is lost in translation because they wouldn't have been able to communicate, we don't think. So they would have used interpreters, for example, interpreting both the language but also the sort of rites going on. But when you look at what's happening, when you look at a lot of that, and you look at a grave like the Oseberg ship, for example, in Norway, things like there's a grave chamber that's really well described. There's a bed in there. There's people buried in them with all their equipment, with all the things, animal sacrifices. We find those in the archaeological record, and that parallel is really quite staggering. So I think with all of that, it just can't be enough of a coincidence, really. So that I really do think that we can believe at least, 75 to 80% of it, and perhaps the rest is embellishment.
I mean, their burial rites, to moderns would say, they had a very, very strange and elaborate religious belief system. How much did the Vikings alternately Christianize, Islamicize, And vice versa? Did the cult of Thor and Woden go the other way?
Yeah, that's another one of those that is quite difficult to pick up on in the archaeological record. Because again, how do you show what religion you're of? So unless you actually make it quite clear in your burial, in something on your body, by, for example, the warrior in Repton was buried with a Thor's hammer around his neck. But then he was also buried right next to a church in a very prominent position next to what we know as a church. And then we have some written records suggesting that people were actually converting as a political tool as well. So some records that suggest that some of the Vikings would just pretend to be Christians if it gave them better trading opportunities, because, perhaps somebody wouldn't trade with a pagan. And so by converting or saying you've converted to Christianity, that gave you an advantage. So we know that certainly happened. And we can see it in burial rites as well. Things seem to happen side by side. So some people get cremated, some people get buried, some get buried with grave goods and some not. And these could all be parts of the religious beliefs. So it does seem like we are talking about societies that were quite open to different religions. They seem to be living side by side. And I think quite often, especially here in Britain or in England, we tend to see it as a very, very clear sort of dichotomy between the Christians and the pagans and always that battle. I think the reality on the ground probably wasn't like that. I think people were much more used to taking bits and pieces. And certainly a lot of the Scandinavian religions weren't so, well, from what we know of them, weren't so prescriptive. So they weren't sort of saying you must only have one god. You could have lots of gods in different circumstances. So again, it's that sort of flexibility, adaptability, I think, that really was a big part of the Viking success, that they could interact with people of so many different cultures and religions and sort of do a bit of a pick and mix of what was preferable at any given time.
Can I end by asking, what is the, you know, moving forward, what are the big questions in your field that you're now working to answer? You know, what don't we know about the Vikings that we think we potentially might be able to?
I think we do still have a lot more evidence coming out of the bones. Obviously, this is a bit of an obsession of mine working as a bioarchaeologist. We are starting to get a lot more evidence from ancient DNA as well. And that's starting to answer some of the big picture of you know, who's going where. But I think we can start to narrow down the timing a bit more as well. We can get more of an idea of dates so we can understand how that happens over time. So who's moving where? What's happening to the women, for example? And are we getting more people coming into Scandinavia? I think we can start to unravel a lot more of that evidence from the individual bodies and actually get a better sense of what happens at the beginning of the Viking Age and what happens later on. And again, that impact of the East in the bigger picture, as we've sort of, we're really starting to open our eyes to that much, much more, not just focusing on the West. But I think that will give us a better idea of then how the Scandinavians fitted into to the world at large, essentially, in that particular timescale.
Kat Jarman, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you for inviting me.